The playwright, Tennessee Williams, once wrote a stage direction about one of his fragile female characters, Laura, in The Glass Menagerie. Williams wanted the music to suggest the quality of looking at a piece of delicately spun glass. He wrote, "You think of two things, how beautiful it is and how easily it can be broken." That's the critic's dilemma, says Daniel Mendelsohn. They worry about beautiful things and fret that they may be broken.
This interconnection between the stuff that you find beautiful and also how easily it's damaged is a sort of a core theme of so much of Greek tragedy and obviously of all kinds of literature. And it just seemed to me, since a lot of what I do in my criticism is to sort of look at how great works of literature, not only classical, but you know, everything from Homer to Virginia Woolf, are reinterpreted and adapted and sometimes hijacked by contemporary culture. Since that's so much of what I write about, it just seemed like a good title.
And so, How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken became the title of Daniel Mendelsohn's new book of critical essays. Mendelsohn is a classicist. He reads Latin and ancient Greek, but he uses the classics to look at popular culture, books, movies, or plays. For instance, he calls Tennessee Williams the 20th century descendant of Euripides because they both loved doomed women, like Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire. And I asked if Williams' characters were tragic in the Greek sense.
No, I mean, I don't think so. I think that, you know, in a Greek tragedy, you see somebody screwing up in some terrible way and how that plays out. And in a certain way, you know, what Williams is interested in is looking at the way it plays out when the mistakes are already made. You know, Blanche has already screwed up. She's already lied. She's already slept with the local boys before she gets to New Orleans. She's already done it. And the play is about watching how that all plays out as a result of her coming into contact with this sort of reagent who is her brother-in-law, Stanley Kowalski. So it's a slightly different emphasis. But of course, as you know, something he has in common with Greek tragedians is he loves to see crazy women fall apart on stage.
Most of the 30 essays in Mendelsohn's book were published in the New York Review of Books, and they range from Medea on Broadway to a novel about Henry James to the film Brokeback Mountain.
One of the things I was trying to do was to read not only the movie, which I loved, but to read the reactions to the movie and to read the culture as a whole. I mean, that's what we do as classicists. We're not just reading the Iliad or just reading Euripides. We're looking at what Bronze Age culture was like, what are the tools, what are the other poems being written, who are the people, what are the politics, the same thing for Athens, which produced Greek tragedy. So I'm, you know, one of the things I do in my reviews is to look not only at the work, but to look at the reception. And in the case of Brokeback Mountain, what fascinated me was that the surround of the movie, the cultural surround, was, I thought, deeply false. You were constantly being told that it was a love story like any other, which, you know, one can see the appeal of that line to the producers of the movie because they're trying to get everyone to see it. But, you know, my point is, read this movie carefully. It's not a love story like any others. These people have different problems even from other star-crossed lovers, like, and the example that I used was Romeo and Juliet. You know, these people not only have to deal with social condemnation, whatever, they have to deal with themselves. They grew up being taught to hate themselves, not just
because they're gay.
Because they're gay, right. And so to deny the specificity of that to the movie struck me as a move that diminished the movie, because this movie was wonderful in at least one sense, because it does what all serious art does, which is to take something very specific and to treat it, and this is just the alchemy of good art, in a way that makes it accessible to everybody else.
You know, I always think of good criticism, Daniel Mendelsohn, and certainly what you've got here in this book, as something that challenges us to think more acutely or to revisit old conceptions or somehow in a new way more fully experience the experience. And for all those reasons, I might have thought that you would avoid quote-unquote reality films like United at 93, which recreates, if you will, the doomed flight that crashed in Pennsylvania on September 11th.
It's not necessarily something I would have chosen to write about, all other things being equal. But, you know, here again, the classics connection comes in, because one of the very few remaining plays that we have by Aeschylus is actually the only extant play in Greek tragedy that treats an actual historical event, which is the invasion of Greece by the Persians. And so my training as a classicist and specifically as somebody who writes about tragedy made me interested to see how a contemporary mass entertainer, because you have to remember Greek tragedy was a mass entertainment, it was not something reserved for the upper elite, how our mass entertainment would treat our own recent historical trauma. And so I was very interested, in fact, to see United 93 and the Oliver Stone movie called World Trade Center. And I was dismayed to a certain extent by how small and parochial and safe these movies were in treating this event, in their refusal to sort of think of the larger ramifications. And as somebody who's fascinated by reality TV, I was very interested in the claims made by the United 93 movie to be a sort of a straight representation of reality with no Hollywood garnish. Because, of course, there was garnish. You know, there was music, right? Mm-hmm. There was music.
But when Aeschylus writes about the Persians' defeat, how do you think he's being more emotionally honest than, say, the filmmakers of United 93?
Well, I think in a way I would even say emotionally honest, yes, but even intellectually and ethically and morally honest. Because what Aeschylus does, he makes a remarkable gesture. He is an Athenian writing 8 years after the enormous Persian hordes invaded his hometown, Athens, and, you know, they burned the temples to the ground. I mean, they destroyed a lot of the city of Athens. Then the Greeks win. And then 8 years later, Aeschylus writes a play called The Persians, which, and, you know, he would have been within his rights as a person writing an entertainment for the Athenian people to gloat over this amazing victory. And what he does instead is he writes a play about what it must have been to be a Persian, to be the king of Persia returning home in defeat. And to my mind, that's a remarkable, really ethical gesture. And, you know, of course, what one got out of United 93 and World Trade Center, if you got anything out of it, was, you know, Americans are heroic. And I'm not saying for a moment that Americans weren't heroic. That's not my point. But I think that in the first major popular culture comment on 9/11, one wanted a wider imagination of what this event meant.
Daniel Mendelsohn's new book of criticism is How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken. He's also the author of The Lost, The Search for Six of 6 Billion. Daniel Mendelsohn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You can find an excerpt from Daniel Mendelsohn's new book and some of my own critical writing on our website, npr.org. Ahead, a troubled narrator and a musical Odd Couple. This is NPR News.
During economic downturns, conventional wisdom has it that hemlines drop and colors darken. In New York, fashion editors, store buyers, and fashionistas have been finding out what the spring fashions will bring. Among those who've been in the thick of Fashion Week is Simon Doonan. He's the creative director of Barney's New York. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you. So you've just been living, I think, at Fashion Week all this week. Break it to us. Are hemlines up or down?
Well, I'm always very amused by that idea that fashion might have these overarching messages, because fashion is sort of this very incoherent place. I mean, I could give you examples. Like in the 60s, short skirts were seen as a sign of a new era of optimism and economic stability, but they were closely followed by very long skirts. So fashion is sort of wonderfully nonsensical and has its own evolution.
Do you think that fashion does respond to the economy, says something about the economy?
I think the buyers respond to the economy. So, for example, I've heard groups of buyers this week saying they're playing it safe, they're going to buy, you know, basics, they're going to buy things that women really need. They're not going to necessarily go for the spangled unitard. They're probably going to invest in items which are less challenging to the consumer and therefore more likely to sell.
What do you mean when you say buyers are buying basics?
Well, you're not actually going to see basics at Fashion Week. Basics is something that the buyer confronts when they go to the showroom. I was at Michael Kors. There was a beautiful jacket that had a big hand-painted stripe all the way around it. And you know when you go to the showroom, you can buy that jacket without the big hand-painted stripe on it, and you're probably going to sell more of the one without the stripe.
What does influence what we end up wearing?
I think there are trends, and what drives them and what drives what people wear is more about change. For example, last spring, the big story from all the runways was color. Color and print, color and print. And then this fall, it's been all about black. And people have said, oh, is this because of the economy and there's this new restraint and blah, blah, blah. But in my opinion, it's more about just a pendulum kind of action between thick and thin, high and low, which is driven by the design process rather than by designers having any sense of the zeitgeist. Because I think designers also look to distinguish themselves from one another. They don't have like a big kind of Dr. Strangelove conclave where they all get together and say, hey, let's do more modest hems because the economy's in the toilet or whatever. They're making their own little zeitgeist in their own little cocoon.
Simon Doonan, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Have me back soon.
Simon Doonan writes the style column in the New York Observer, and he's author of the new book, Eccentric Glamour.
Okay, absolutely no way to put lipstick on this transition. Here we go, from politics to something far, far away. Superman's house.
Well, actually, it's the house of Superman's creator. His name is Jerry Siegel. He dreamt up Superman back in the 1930s in his modest home in Cleveland. That home is now under threat, and a group of comic book fans is holding an eBay auction to help preserve it. From member station WCPN, Mari Saito reports.
As a child in rural Mississippi, Jefferson Gray loved hearing stories about Superman. Gray grew up, moved to Cleveland, got a job in a steel foundry, and got married. 25 years ago, with small children to raise and more on the way, superheroes were the last thing on his mind. He went looking in Cleveland's Glenville neighborhood to buy a house.
I looked at other houses in the neighborhood, but then some mind brought me right back to this house. So I said, honey, we're going to buy this house.
Gray had no idea that his family had moved into Superman co-creator Jerry Siegel's old house. In 1986, the city of Cleveland declared the house a landmark, and that's when the fans showed up. Some by the busload, some alone, driving hundreds of miles to pay homage to Jerry Siegel. Gray's family always let visitors tour the place where Superman was born.
This is the bedroom where Jerry Siegel was, and this is the closet. Most people say he wrote most of Superman stuff from here.
Gray points to a small space off the back of the bedroom. There's a chair next to the window and some books on a table.
I like to look out that window sometimes. It's a beautiful view at nighttime when you see the moon and everything. So it's beautiful.
But Gray admits that the room, and well, much of the house, is anything but beautiful. Decades of water damage have marked the house. Plaster is falling off the walls. Mike San Giacomo started writing about the Siegel House in 1989 for the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
It was in better shape then, but I was kind of disheartened that there was no kind of plaque from the city. And so for the last 19 years, I've been talking about the need to do something to honor Superman in Cleveland.
But nothing has happened. Then San Giacomo's friend, novelist Brad Meltzer, called up some of the biggest names in the comic book industry and formed the Siegel and Schuster Society. The nonprofit started collecting original art for an eBay auction. All the money goes to fix up the house. Meltzer says he then called Jerry Siegel's widow, Joanne, to tell her their plans.
And suddenly she says to me, Brad, before my husband passed, he signed 6 shirts and said to me that if you ever need money, sell the shirts. And no one knows these shirts exist. I want you to have one of these shirts for this auction.
Other items on the list include a walk-on part in NBC's hit series Heroes and VIP tickets to Stephen Colbert's show The Colbert Report. Brian Bendis pens the comic book Powers. He says his auction offering is a tribute to Siegel and Shuster. Superman's creators signed over the rights to their iconic character to a precursor of DC Comics, but then spent decades in court fighting to get them back.
Things have changed so much because of what they did that now I own my own book, so I can do whatever I want. And Powers is a book that I own, and now you can be in it if you win the auction.
Sitting on his porch, which is peeling blue and red paint, Superman's colors, homeowner Jefferson Gray says he hasn't looked at the items up for sale. Over the years, he's heard lots of plans to fix up this place, and they've all fallen through. The online auction goes through the rest of the month, saving Superman's house, comic book fans say, is the least they can do for their hero. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito in Cleveland.
Move over, Hello Kitty and Pokemon. The new pop culture craze from Japan is ball-jointed dolls, BJDs, as they're known to their human friends. In the past year, the number of Asian companies selling the dolls in the U.S. has quadrupled, with tens of millions of dollars in sales. But they're not child's play. As Nancy Mullane reports, the adults who collect these dolls are totally devoted.
The first time you see a ball-jointed doll is blink your eyes shocking. They're hand-sculpted, hand-painted, anatomically correct, and so realistic, they're perfectly human-looking. And the growing number of women who own them get together at conferences to share their love for BJDs.
I've been really excited, you know, just to see other people. So when you go to conventions like this, you get really, really excited. Yeah.
Jude Wolfe and her mom, Char Southall, have just driven 2 hours to attend this, their first BJD convention. Now they're in the lobby of San Francisco's Holiday Inn, frantically changing their dolls out of their traveling clothes.
Yeah, I'm actually dressing my doll just so that she's going to look okay when I take her downstairs to meet all the other dolls and when we go around and have a look at the different doll shops and see what they've got to sell so that she can choose some more wigs and some more outfits and just look presentable.
Southall settles on a red and black striped hooded jacket and puts it on Su-Yun, her knee-high BJD.
The lovely thing about these dolls is that they are ball-jointed. They move at the feet, at the knees, at the waist, and then the wig comes off, which I'll...
When she changes her doll's straight black wig to a curly white one, Su-Yun looks completely different. No longer a Cher look-alike, but a teenage Dolly Parton in hot pants.
She looks good in them.
And that's the beauty of owning a BJD. Owners can recreate a perfectly idealized version of themselves over and over again. Jenny O'Brien walks up holding Arabella Twig, one of her 8 BJDs. She says she loves being able to change everything about her dolls, their wigs, hands, feet, bust size, even their eyes.
Eyes will bankrupt you. Eyes are anywhere from $30 to $100 for nice eyes.
And having a doll put the eyes in is even more expensive. People spend hundreds, even thousands of dollars buying just one BJD, sight unseen, off the internet. Yunju Lim is foreign trade manager for Elf Doll, one of the larger manufacturers of BJDs in South Korea.
We are getting more retail in the United States, in Canada, in Germany, and really everywhere.
And everywhere it's an obsession. Jennifer Cohn-Murtha is with the United Federation of Doll Collectors. When she starts talking about her ball-jointed doll, Kimora, it's as if she's talking about a child.
I have one 15-year-old girl who is my love, and I have ordered for her a boyfriend who is a boxer and a physicist who will take good care of her, and I have also ordered her a vampire. I couldn't resist.
At the convention, BJD owners are shelling out hundreds of dollars for mind-blowingly beautiful Armani-esque wool-lined coats, black wraparound pocket dresses, and garnet-embedded jewelry for their dolls. Maggie Wagner is a psychotherapist and says she's crazy about her 5 BJDs. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I'm 34 years old, I'm a grown woman, and I play with dolls, and it's okay, like I've owned it, you know, I'm all right with it.
There's another ball-jointed doll convention coming up later this month in Austin, Texas.
For NPR News, I'm Nancy Mullane in San Francisco.
And you can find pictures of these hand-painted, ball-jointed dolls at our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.